Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'm sorry, who are you again? The European Union on the broadcast today and what Google is allowed to remember about you. The early days of the video game wars as well, and an Arkansas Razorback out in the North Dakota oil patch. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 13th of May, and who among us hasn't had this happen? You Google yourself just because, you know, you're curious, and up pops something you'd really rather not have memorialized online for all of eternity. As of today, lucky Europeans have recourse on that. The European Union's highest court has ruled that individuals can ask Google, Bing, Yahoo, or any other major search engine to remove some of the links that come up when their name is searched. As you might imagine, the decision has big business implications for search companies, and it also highlights the data divide between us and them. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
The case deals with the so-called right to be forgotten. The European court said because search results have such a major impact on people's lives, people should have the right to have certain things removed.
You talked about your credit report. This is your Google report.
Danny Sullivan is the founding editor of Search Engine Land.
On a personal basis, that's a big impact for some people. There are cases where many people would be sympathetic to the idea that there's something unflattering about them that is also old or perhaps outdated.
One of the plaintiffs is a surgeon who requested an article from 1991 be removed about an operation he'd performed that had gone badly. Greg Sterling is an analyst at Opus Research.
There are a number of gray areas here that pit the right of the individual to control his or her reputation against the public's right to know.
Can Americans expect to request the removal of bad haircuts and DUIs?
No, not at all. In the United States, the First Amendment would prevent such an outcome.
Sterling says this highlights the different views on data between the U.S. and the EU.
I think that they see any data associated with an individual as personal, private information. The view in the U.S. is more skewed toward making that information not the property of an individual, but something that can be utilized by other parties.
Search engine companies would not have to comply with every request. How the ruling will play out is unclear. Google told Marketplace it was disappointed by the decision, but needed time to analyze the implications. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two big mortgage companies firmly in the hands of government conservatorship since the earliest days of the financial crisis, are in the news today. The new-ish head of the agency that runs them wants to loosen up the still-tight mortgage market and, by so doing, just maybe give the housing recovery a bit of a boost. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
In some cities, people get excited about movie stars. Here in Washington, we have Mel Watt, the new head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, which oversees Fannie and Freddie. Watt was sworn in last January, but hasn't said much in public since. So there was an expectant hum of chatter this morning before Watt took the podium at the Brookings Institution in Washington.
You haven't heard much from me, but it does not mean that we have not been working.
What's Watt been working on? This year's strategic plan for Fannie and Freddie, aimed at getting banks to lend more. The way it works now, Fannie and Freddie buy mortgages from banks and guarantee them. But Fannie and Freddie make banks buy them back if there's a problem, even if it's just a minor paperwork glitch. Watt says Fannie and Freddie will ease up carefully.
Since any stumbles along the way could have ripple effects in the $10 trillion housing finance market, there's a lot at stake in getting this right.
If Watt gets it right, analysts say banks will be more willing to lend to first-time or low-income homebuyers because they won't be so worried about having to buy their loans back. Will Watt's plan be enough to rev up the housing market, which has been limping along in second gear?
Well, I think it's going to stop us from going in reverse.
That's Tim Rood, a former executive at Fannie Mae, now chairman of the Collingwood Group. But if the housing market speeds up too fast, will it overheat? Not a chance, according to Guy Sakala, the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
You know, if the speed limit is 65, we're still going along at 45, but it's better than 30 or whatever we were at before.
Sakala says even with Watt's changes, banks will still be cautious. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yeah, you know, fine. Whatevs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. News reports and doom and gloom headlines to the contrary. The fact of the matter is that we do still make stuff in this country. It's a different kind of manufacturing than it used to be, but manufacturing it is with decent pay as well. A lot of the rote work is being done by machines, which means today's factory workers need to know more math and engineering than they did before. So high schools are combining some of the latest technologies with a very old idea. Marketplace's Mark Garrison takes us to class in upstate New York to check it out.
We're here working with a 3D printer right now.
High school juniors and seniors huddle around a 3D printer as their teacher explains how a digital pattern gets it to slice up plastics. One asks if they can print out a person.
In a plastic form, yes.
I know what I'm doing with my 3D printer. 3D selfies.
I've always wanted.
They're taking advanced classes at the high school and college level through a program that brings them to a tech-focused campus. They're here from schools across New York because their passion for technology earned them recommendations from their teachers. So they've got serious questions, too.
Do you think it'll be, like, faster?
Programs like this are growing, driven by companies that want skilled workers and educators that want students to get good jobs as engineers, designers, programmers, and technicians. Students here study hot fields like nanotechnology and green building, a draw for Michaela Regner.
My passion right now is sustainable architecture.
Not something she can specialize in at her home high school. But here, she gets hands-on access to new technology in the type of place she wants to build.
I absolutely love this building because it envelops everything that is just fantastic. Like, the windows are specially angled so the sun can come in during some seasons, and it's just amazing to me.
Are we going to see these in, like, factories where they make small little parts, like when parts break?
Global companies like Cisco and regional firms provide mentoring, equipment, and money to cover college tuition. Grants and public school funds take care of the rest, totaling around $11,000 per student each year. Students like Jake Fortin and their parents appreciate the opportunity to take college classes without getting stuck with the bill.
First, the college credit, because it's free and college is super expensive now.
The little cutting tool. Well, actually, these are the anti-glue pens.
But their teacher, Daryl Aykroyd, says the big draw is the chance to get their hands on the latest stuff.
This is the place to be, and this is where you want to go. Because think about the technology that's going to happen in 5 years from now. And it's just about trying to get them to get back that creative spot.
He's young, with a hipster beard and man bun. But he's also kind of a throwback to a character these students' grandparents would recognize, the shop teacher. Schools are bringing back the tradition of showing students how to work with their hands, this time with a high-tech twist. Now, instead of a birdhouse and a mouthful of sawdust, students get skills that pay.
We're preparing our students for jobs that don't exist yet.
Laura Logan King is assistant superintendent at Ballston Spa Central School District, which runs this program for students from 20 New York school districts. Its partnership with higher ed and industry is new, so part of her job is explaining how technology some find strange or even scary is creating jobs in energy, IT, manufacturing, and more.
It's really about creating that awareness, not only for the students, but also for the parents, so that they can have an understanding about, well, what are these new opportunities that are going to be available for my children?
Between classes, students meet to collaborate on projects under the soaring ceiling of the energy-efficient building. One of them is Morgan Pacatar, who remembers when she first suited up for the nanotech lab.
And I'm just like, I feel cool. Like, this is awesome. Like, this is what I want to do, so I'm enjoying it.
Because she's got a jump on college, the seniors are already looking ahead to local tech firms where she might want to start her career.
I know there's a lot of places opening up around here. GE is always an option, Evident Technologies.
That's what educators and tech companies want, a new generation of workers with hands-on skill for the jobs of the future. This new program graduated its first class last year, so we'll soon see if the investment pays off. In Malta, New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The great state of North Dakota is the land of opportunity if you're looking for work in the oil and gas business. The fracking boom has done nothing less than transform the western part of that state, often overwhelming the small towns that dot the prairie out there. There are, of course, lots of comings and goings in and out of the oil fields. Independent producer Todd Melby has been keeping track of them in a series called Black Gold Boom. Today, a Razorback making ribs for the Roughnecks, a guy named Oscar Everetts.
How many ribs can you eat with a fork? People
know.
Want them cut? That's an insult. My name's Oscar Everetts from Fort Smith, Arkansas. There's no sauce, no nothing. Go get me a hot and a mild. Yeah, we're Arkansas Razorbacks. I'm from Fort Smith, Arkansas. He's from Alma, Arkansas, which is about 20 miles away. And we are the Razorback State. I mean, Woo Pig Suey's our call for our football players and everybody.
How does that go?
Woo Pig Suey! Sorry, my throat hurts. But it goes a lot louder than that normally. And we're crazy as the Razorback. You'd have to be crazy to do this. For where I live at, it's down. You can't hardly find a job. The wages have gone down. And I came out here and I had an epiphany. I said, I want to cook for these guys. I said, they don't have food. You go to Walmart, those shelves are empty in Williston.
So is your plan to move your family up here with you?
No. Nope, I won't ever leave Arkansas. Okay. Arkansas boys are Arkansas boys. God's country is Arkansas. We're the natural state. We have every resource in the United States and the world, including diamonds. We're the diamond state. We have diamonds, gold, silver, oil, natural gas, trees everywhere. But there are no whole companies there. They're all here. And that's why we're here. Arkansas's not like this. We're in the mountains. This is we're farm country too, but we're in the mountains. Yeah. And that's probably why we like to cook so much. And moonshine to swine is what we say.
Todd Melby's series, Black Gold Boom, is a project of Prairie Public and the Association for Independence in Radio. Coming up.
The console industry really exploded as a result of this battle between Sega and Nintendo.
The console wars, but first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial is up 19 points today. 10th percent closed at an all-time high of 16,715. Maybe I'll stop saying that all-time high thing. I don't know. The NASDAQ, on the other hand, sank 13 points, a third of 1%, 4130 there. The S&P 500, pretty steady all day, really. Ended basically flat at 1897. The Wall Street Journal reports, again, that AT&T is close to an agreement to buy DirecTV. It's a $50 billion deal if it happens. Both DirecTV and AT&T down more than a percent today. Satellite rival Dish Network up a 10%, while broadband internet provider and cable behemoth Comcast slipped a full percent today. Google stock pretty much unfazed by that European ruling on the right to be forgotten. It channeled up almost 0.6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases a producer price index for April. Macy's is scheduled to report quarterly earnings. And hold that door, dude. National Etiquette Week continues. Thank you. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Once again, the purchasing habits of the American consumer are at the center of the business and economic news of the day. Retail sales for April came out this morning. The Commerce Department says we all bought collectively $343 billion worth of stuff last month. That is a 10% more, just to give you some context here, than we bought in March. Not all that much more, really, given how much better the weather was, though. So what gives? Sally Herships has the story.
What does this 0.1%, the increase for April's retail sales, really represent?
Well, I don't know that a small trend like that would really kind of say anything major about consumers.
Marlene Morris-Towns teaches marketing at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business. She says the uptick in March sales, about three times as much, could be explained by spring, because who wants to shop in bad weather? But
I think that it gets tricky when you start looking at small differences from month to month rather than bigger trends.
Like year over year. Morristown says comparing monthly numbers can be like finding a picture of Elvis in our toast. We could be searching for non-existent patterns and then trying to explain it away with weather, job numbers, or holidays.
Well, that's why it used to be, I don't know how many stores reported, maybe 20, 30. It's down to very, very few stores report now, precisely for that reason, because it doesn't give a clear picture.
Barbara Kahn teaches marketing at Wharton, and she's talking about retailers that have stopped reporting their own month-to-month same-store sales, like JCPenney's and Macy's.
One of the reasons it's been looked at so much in the last 3, 4, 5 years was to see, you know, whether the signs of the economy, because the retail sales is a very good indicator of whether or not we're fully out of the recession and if the economy is rebounding.
And Kahn says if you look at April sales compared to last year, the numbers are better. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We told you yesterday about products, brand names, really, that have become just plain everyday words. Kleenex, Xerox, aspirin, you get the gist. Here is another one that'll help get us into this next story. Google, as in go Google it if you really want to know. But there are, hard as it may be to believe, other online ways of finding things out. Venture capitalists are pouring money into sites and apps that take different approaches to answering your questions. But first, they have to convince you to stop Googling. Sam Harnett reports.
Oh, come on. Don't lie now. We've all had this question before.
What causes hiccups?
Karthik Ramakrishnan is the COO of Ask.com. You know, the old Ask Jeeves, a search engine where you could have looked up what causes hiccups. We'll get to that answer in a minute, but this is the kind of question Ask.com is now trying to answer.
We're the granddaddy of going and asking the world to answer these questions.
He says everyone knows Google won the search game a long time ago. So Ask.com is trying to fill a niche as a question and answer site. It isn't alone. Social networks, search engines, and new apps are all trying to answer your questions. Still, if you had a question, why wouldn't you just Google it?
There is not one way in which you can actually come up with answers to people's questions.
For instance, with Google, you can't use your phone to pose a question with a picture. You also can't ask for responses from experts or your friends. Venture capitalists think these new approaches can make some money. Take Quora. It's kind of like a social network where users can post questions and answers. It recently got $80 million of investment. All its content comes for free from writers like Alan Ahmet.
I can't stand seeing an answer or someone needing an answer that I have and not responding.
Quora currently has no revenue stream, and if the social network falls apart, so does the site. Why would a venture capitalist take this risk?
We think about it as, is there a fundamental behavior that is happening in the product that somebody will pay for?
Josh Ellman is a VC at Greylock Partners. It invested in Jelly. It's a mobile app that allows people to take a picture and use it to ask a question. Imagine, Ellman says, someone has an emergency with a leaky pipe. They snap a picture of it and ask what's wrong. A nearby plumber replies with a solution. That, Ellman says, could generate revenue.
I think that there's just so many questions that aren't just easily answered with a 3 or 4 word search, because the answer isn't always on a website. It might be in somebody's head.
Quora and Jelly are taking two different approaches to answering questions. Ramakrishnan from Ask.com says that's the key to the business, understanding what users are really asking for.
our angle on this is let's also do a better job at helping the user craft and formulate what those questions themselves might be.
Ask.com throws a wide net for answers. They give search results, peer-written responses, even content they pay to produce. But not everyone is pleased. Computer scientist Jerry Feldman is a harsh critic.
The notion that either an automated system or some social networking system will be a reliable source of information about everything you want to know is very unlikely.
Okay, but even if we don't have perfect answers, there's some money to be made here. Oh, by the way, Ask.com can tell you what causes hiccups. A lot of things. Carbonated beverages, an irritated diaphragm, alcohol. As for why we get them, well, some things we still don't have a good answer for. I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
If you've ever played video games, even like a long time ago, you've almost certainly heard of Super Mario. Probably Sonic the Hedgehog, too. They sometimes even appear in games together nowadays. But back in the early 90s, their parent companies, Sega and Nintendo, were a whole lot less friendly toward each other. Blake Harris writes about the console wars between Sega and Nintendo in his new book called, appropriately enough, Console Wars. Blake, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Kai. I'm very excited to be here.
I'll tell you what, Sega and Nintendo, it sounds like a zillion years ago, man.
It was a long time ago, but you know what? It still lives with a lot of people my age and our parents who were forced to listen to us demanding and complaining for the latest and greatest Sega products. And it also, you know, aside from the personal standpoint, really created tons of ripples that evolved into what we have today, the modern video game industry.
And we will get there, but why don't you set the scene for me, set the stage. Back in the day when this book takes place, Sega and Nintendo were not exactly equals in the marketplace, shall we say.
No, there was some inequality in the marketplace. In 1989, Nintendo controlled over 90% of the market. It was just a staggering success. They were a juggernaut. And then there was Sega, which was fighting with a few other companies for that remaining 10% of the market, and they got absolutely whooped. Things weren't going well until Tom Kalinske took over and a certain blue hedgehog really changed their fortunes.
And therein lies the tale. And I'm not going to spoil it for people, but I will sort of get to the end of this book. In what, 5 years, he takes Sega from 5% of the market to 55% of the market before some unfortunate declines. But how does he do that? I mean, this is kind of an amazing come from nowhere story.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think of the video game industry, especially as a kid, it was just whoever makes the best games is going to win the console wars or is going to make products that I buy. But from a business standpoint, that's not how it works. Even if you have the best game ever, you have to find distribution for it. And Nintendo did such a wonderful job of controlling the distribution network so that companies like Sega were unable to get their products into retailers because they feared that they would anger Nintendo and lose some of the allocations. And one of the great examples was with Walmart, which was not willing to carry the Sega Genesis, regardless of whether it was a better system or a good, strong competitor. Tom Kalinske and his right-hand man, Shinobu Toyota, decided to open a Genesis store across the street from Walmart's headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, which offered the opportunity for people of all ages to play the Genesis for free. And when they wanted to buy it, they would go into Walmart and ask for the Genesis and find out, nope, it's not stocked here.
Cannot leave this topic without talking about Mario the Plumber and this hedgehog thing that Sega came up with, Sonic the Hedgehog. Perhaps the most unlikely corporate mascot ever, right, this hedgehog?
Yeah, I mean, I had never heard of a hedgehog before, and I was not alone. Neither had any of the executives at Sega. You know, if we go back to with Nintendo having 90% of the marketplace and Sega fighting for scraps, to take down Nintendo, they really wanted to create a Mario killer. And so they held an internal mascot contest, which resulted in rabbits, teddy bears, little weebly wobbly eggs. And the selection that won was this hedgehog that was called Mr. Needle Mouse originally and became Sonic. Sega of America and Sega of Japan worked to take this game with this innovative, fast gameplay and turn it into a global icon. And if you look around today, Sonic is as pervasive as ever.
You know, it's interesting. You say Sonic is around, but Sega is kind of an afterthought. I mean, yes, you aficionados sort of know it, but in the wider world, Sega who?
As much as we all remember Sega as very successful on this big battle with Nintendo, Sega over here at one point did have 55 or 60% of the market, but in Japan it never really surpassed 25%. And so there was this very strange dynamic where the parent company that was making the majority of the games was not thriving, and this subsidiary run by Tom Kalinske was excelling and changing what video games were. And I think that there was enmity and jealousy and some spite at times, which led Sega to cutting off the nose to spite the face, and that spite really led to Sega's downfall.
It's a book called Console Wars about Sega and Nintendo back in the day. Blake Harris wrote it. Blake, thanks very much for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This is one of those stories that just takes you back. As I said, you can check out the vintage Sega Genesis ad that we've got on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which one feels just a little bit embarrassed for former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. He's got a new book out, as you may have heard, and as what I imagine is part of a publicity campaign, the website Charity Buzz auctioned off lunch with Mr. Geithner today. Proceeds to benefit the RFK Center for Justice and Human Rights. $50,000, $50,000 was the winning bid, which is nice and all for the RFK Center for Justice and Human Rights, but a good deal shy of the 2013 record holder, a $610,000 lunch with Apple CEO Tim Cook. So there you go. I'm not even going to auction myself off. Forget it. That's just asking for trouble. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Nancy Fargali is our senior producer of special projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.